Hey, Dana Levitt from Levitt Robinson. How you doing there? It's Megan.
Hi, Megan. I'm really well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, pretty good. Thanks for agreeing to come on. Really do appreciate it. We're running these restorative hour every single week from here in, and our first person, of course, is yourself because you're behind the class action with Banksia Hill and all the other wonderful things that you've been doing in community.
And we'll declare a partiality conflict. We are involved with the Banksia Hill class action. We have helped collect testimonies, but we wanted to get you on because it's a historic class action, and we wanted you as the managing lawyer of the class action, with your dad Stuart Levitt leading the class action and alongside others too. But you as the managing lawyer of the class action, just to talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I think that it's pretty shocking when you consider what's going on in Western Australia currently, has been going on in Western Australia for decades. And certainly it seems to be down to a lack of political will and bureaucratic incompetency. I'm quoting Dennis Reynolds, ex-president of the Children's Court there. People just seem to have grown accustomed to the state-sanctioned torture of children in Western Australia. And it certainly is a very, very sorry state of affairs. So, yeah, I mean, to talk about the class action itself, basically anyone who's ever been detained at Banksia Hill or its predecessor, Rangeview, is eligible to join the class action, which alleges against the state of Western Australia discrimination on the basis of age, disability and race. I'm pleased to say our complaint at the Australian Human Rights Commission was accepted some time ago. We're waiting on notice from the President of the Human Rights Commission as to whether it will be terminated or will go to conciliation. But certainly, the feeling is that due to the nature and the seriousness of the allegations that we say happened to kids inside Banksia and are still happening right now, actually, it's unlikely that we can sit down and talk about this because certainly nothing's changed in decades. And to consider what's going on in Unit 18 right now, and the fact that it's been going on for more than a month, it really beggars belief. It seems litigation is really the only way to bring about some real change in Western Australia. So that's what we're doing.
And what sort of change are you looking for in Western Australia or at Banksia Hill Juvenile Detention Centre?
I think that what's happening in Banksia Hill is it's really hard to understand, in that it has no upside whatsoever. So the kids that are detained there are among the nation's most disadvantaged. Many of them, 9 out of 10, have mental disability and are not capable of understanding their actions in the way that a child who was of normal mental capacity may have. Now, the question whether a child can really be held to be criminally responsible is one that requires some consideration. I do not believe that a 10-year-old is capable of understanding the consequences of his actions and the moral wrongness of those actions, which is the standard that's required for criminal capacity in Australia. So basically what we have is a situation where kids who are already among the most disadvantaged go into a place where they receive nothing, no education, no therapeutic interventions. They are subjected to punitive conditions that are more severe than those that the most serious adult offenders are subjected to. I mean, if you consider that rapists and murderers in Casuarina prison are having a better time of it than the kids who are detained in Unit 18 and or Banksia Hill, you really have to scratch your head and wonder what's going on here. Now, in addition to that, these kids are then released. They have no support when they're released, and so they often reoffend and then are institutionalized into adulthood. So they go from Banksia Hill to Casuarina, and then if they make it out of jail, which many of them don't due to the rates of Indigenous deaths in custody, they've got nothing really use, to work with, to be, you know, fully fledged and successful members of society, because they don't have the skills.
Dana, can you let me be the devil's advocate for fairness to the Department of Justice and Department of Corrective Services? So
sure.
The Department of Corrective Services and the state government would actually argue that they do have education programs in there, that they do have therapeutic and rehabilitative programs in there. What do you have to say to that?
I think it's one thing to make declarations of what you think is the state of affairs, but I would ask Mark McGowan and Christine Ginby to actually look at the cell management report for the detainees.
For listeners, could you explain who Christine is?
She is the Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Justice, who went on the Department of Justice's website and recorded a video in which she talks about how wonderful everything is at Unit 18 and how wonderful everything will be for the kids at Banksia Hill once the kids are transferred there. Now, I can tell you, because I know, and I have documentary evidence to support what I'm saying, there has not been a single day of school since those children entered Unit 18. Now, the kids at Banksia Hill have also been subject to weeks of extended lockdowns and disruption to their own school program, which, I mean, is suboptimal at best, right? So I would say, if I'm allowed to swear, I call bullshit.
Dana, can I just ask another question? You talked about support post-release or if there's an arrest and release culture. And I'll give a sad statistic. No one so far in terms of Banksia Hill, even though it's looking more and more likely that will be the case and pray it isn't, has actually died in custody. In Don Dale, yes, there has been a child that has died in custody, a 15-year-old child from Groot Island. But post-release, if we dip into the National Coronial Database, we'll find that over the last 20 years, in the first year or two post-release, there have been more than 100 children or youth who have died post-Banksia. Mostly by suicide or misadventure. And isn't it sad that Banksia Hill is a more secure circumstance in terms of deaths in custody, and we've got these deaths after custody? What supports aren't being put in place? What can we do?
I think that we should really start with the simplest thing to change, which it would be the Department of Communities and the Department of Child Protection adhering to their obligations under the Young Offenders Act and the Children and Community Services Act. And that is maintaining connection between detainees and their families whilst they're in custody, and ensuring that where there is a family who is willing to provide love and support to the child, that family is included in the decision-making process. In my experience to date, I have found that far from being helpful or facilitative of family interaction, both departments have been quite obstructive. And when there is, you know, very abundant evidence of a family member's commitment to a child, as there has been for one of the detainees, I simply cannot understand I can't think of a possible justification for not making sure that children are supported by their family members or their community whilst they're incarcerated.
Let's also remember that 50% or 50% of children are in the care of the state.
That's right. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Now, just because a child is in the care of the state does not mean that there is not a single person amongst their family, their kith, their kin, their community, with whom they could maintain contact and derive some real support, right? So impeding that contact is unjustifiable in my mind. Now, when kids are released from Banksia Hill and there's all these programs and services which you know, the Department of Justice and Department of Corrective Services will tell you are available to children. Now, these children will apply to them time and time again, and you know what will happen? They'll either take months to be accepted into a program, by which time they may already have reoffended. the services to which they're referred are overwhelmed by demand and don't have the resources to meet the demand for support, for therapeutic support, for psychological assessments that are capable of working out what treatment a child needs to succeed in life.
Yeah, no, they're really difficult circumstances, and, you know, these have been some of the challenges over in Western Australia right now. As you know, there's 1 in 12 Aboriginal men that are in prison, and it's just getting worse. And, you know, working with the National Suicide Prevention Trauma Recovery Project, we've worked with about 21,000 people right across the country, but in Western Australia, we see the lack of supports, even in the homes. We know the situation with the housing crisis over in Western Australia, but also child removals and so forth. And it's absolutely disgusting, it's disgraceful, and there's so many failures.
I can give you a concrete example. There's a kid who has almost successfully died twice in the last couple of weeks whilst detained in Unit 18, who has a foster mother who has demonstrated unwavering support for him, but who lacks legal standing. So every time this kid tries to kill himself, instead of informing his foster mother, whom he loves and who I've heard him say directly to her, and he loves her and calls her his mum, instead of including them and or supporting her in her efforts to give him a stable home when he leaves, they've denied her any financial support, and he may not have a bed to sleep in when he's released. So, you know, I mean, obviously, between Jerry, Megan and myself, we'll rally and make sure that he does have a bed to sleep in. But the question begs, what is the Department of Community's role in all of this? Is it to help or to hinder?
Dana, we have a few questions that were put to us to ask yourself, and we'll put these questions to you from usual listeners. The first question is, when will the class action hit the federal court?
Any day?
Literally
any day.
So you're saying it's imminent?
I'm saying it's imminent. We're waiting on the President of the Australian Human Rights Commission, as I explained, to let us know whether she intends to terminate the complaint, which we expect. From that point onwards, it's all systems go.
So you have more than 500 plaintiffs. Once it hits the federal court, can people still apply to be...
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely, and I would encourage everyone and anyone to do so. You don't have to do very much in order to be a group member in the class action. All you have to do is demonstrate that you're actually at Banks of the Hill. So it's a pretty short process, and it means that you can stand to benefit from some justice and holding Western Australia to account for the mistreatment you experienced whilst in Banksia Hill.
So, Dana, I've got to ask the question. You've taken a lot of testimonies. What's some of the feelings speaking to the mothers, to the children, to the ones that have been incarcerated previously? Are they excited about this? Are they happy that something's been done? What are your thoughts?
I think that this has given people some hope, but I think that until such time as, you know, we're in court and everything's being aired in public, in the court of public opinion, they won't really believe it's happening because, let's face it, the people that are the group members and who I've spoken to and the parents have had pretty awful lives today, filled with trauma, structural disadvantage, loss by suicide, death in custody. It's really, really, really heartbreaking stuff to hear. So I can understand that there's a feeling of hopelessness amongst people in the community, and it breaks my heart to see it. But know that litigation does work. I mean, our firm was behind the successful class action against the Queensland government's institutional racism on Palm Island, which, you know, resulted in significant compensation to those people. And
It was massive. It was massive compensation. It was massive compensation. You understate. We have to state it just for the listeners. That was an immense victory, and it was the first time such litigation on the grounds of discrimination and racial discrimination were actually won against a state government, which was Queensland through the Attorney General's office, and also against the Queensland Police. It was a massive $30 million success for the Palmer Islanders.
And that was $30 million for about 400 people. So it was a substantial amount. But it's not about the money. That's not what this is about. Money's a good, it's the cherry on top. And I know for people who don't have lots of money, that sounds like a stupid and privileged thing to say. But money's not going to change anyone's future. The only thing that will change people's futures is if the Department of Justice, the Department of Corrective Services, and youth justice in Western Australia undergoes a fundamental change. It needs to start from scratch because, you know, it ain't working.
So how can a successful or a favourable court ruling actually compel reform?
Well, it compels reform because governments don't like to have to pay out hundreds of millions of dollars time and again. So if a court finds that a practice or the way in which legislation is being implemented in a state is actually discriminatory, they have to change it.
Just for listeners to broaden their understandings, and the program will go across the nation at different times. Do you want to tell listeners about some of your other actions across the country? I understand that you don't have to name names, but you can talk in generically. But I understand you've got an action with Wadair and other actions going on across the country. And indefinite detention is another one. But Wadair, the Wadair one in the Northern Territory, do you want to speak to some of that work?
Sure. It's an interesting situation you have in Wadair. It's the biggest Indigenous community in the Northern Territory, and yet it has the least resources. Now, it's hard to understand on what basis they've been denied, you know, the fundamentals. You go there and it's literally, it's covered in rubbish. It has no working roads. The roads get flooded all the time. There's inter-tribal warfare going on that no one is doing anything effective about. And the community is fractured and also poverty-stricken.
And what do you hope to achieve for them?
We hope to achieve, we hope to make sure that going forward, Wadair is provided with adequate resources so that it can stop being like a third world community that's, you know, plagued by violence, and actually start to become a community where, you know, people are, they can maintain their traditional values. I mean, the women's workshop and the men's workshop, for example, have been closed there for years. The public pool's been closed. There's been no football, right? And the reason there's been none of those things going on, the reason there's been no community values or any sort of drive to make things better is because there is nothing there to bring people together.
On a lighthearted note, do you want to talk about Megan's driving skills? As Megan was actually being employed by Levitt and Robinson, she was in Wadair with you collecting testimonies. Do you want to talk about her driving skills and how she gets bogged, not just once, but twice?
I think it's probably better that I don't. It doesn't bear remembering, but basically Megan managed to get a ute that wasn't a four-wheel drive bogged not once but twice in the remote parts of Wadair and had to be towed not once but twice, much to the dismay of the man whose car it was. But, you know, you live, you learn.
Yeah, that was certainly an experience. But, Dana, you know, I've got to give credit to where it's due. Going up to the Wadair with you and the team from Levitt Robinson over in Sydney, that was absolutely incredible. And I saw the way that you engaged with the ladies, with some of the gentlemen, with the children. It was just it was just incredible. Going to the homes, sitting on the floors, in community. I thought the way that you engaged with the mob up that way was just absolutely beautiful. and just being able to extract the necessary information is a testament to you and the team, and you can see the experience of you and the team working with Aboriginal people right across the country, and I'm really pleased to be associated with you guys.
Thank you. And on that note, I can also understand in places like Wadaa why there is a feeling of some animosity directed at white people, because white people have a lot to answer for. Mm. So, you know, now that I've been there a couple of times and people know that I'm a good white person, hopefully, it's really nice to feel the energy change in the place. And it become like a really welcoming, it's sort of like Cheers now, the bar where everyone knows your name, but it's not a bar because it's a dry community, obviously. But you get my drift.
There's 13 bail houses in the Kimberley. Apparently all have been closed since because of understaffing issues, which is a management issue in effect, since July. But the Broom bail house and the Kununurra bail house have been closed, and several children were flown to Perth the other day. And the flight in the first instance was aborted. They had three children on board. There was an incident. And they later chartered two of those three on the same day, and the other one's to be chartered today. But what do you have to say? What do you think? That we can't even keep bail houses open.
I think that, again, the situation is ridiculous. I mean, the idea that you have one juvenile facility to service the whole Western Australia is ridiculous. And it means that kids who are either on remand or are being sentenced are put in a situation where they are hundreds of miles and kilometres, thousands of kilometres, sorry, from their homes. And that causes them significant psychological distress. And I think that's what we're seeing being acted out on these aeroplanes, because these children are terrified. They're children at the end of the day. Let's not forget that. I mean, they're children, and they're being put on a plane in handcuffs to be transported thousands of kilometres away from everything they know.
Uprooted.
It doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me they're flipping out.
Well, we're coming pretty much to the close, but I'd like to get your views on the Royal Commission into Ashley Juvenile Detention Centre in Tasmania. And I'm sure that yourself and Stuart and the legal team have kept yourselves availed to what's coming out of it, and it's horrific. Do you see much the sameness, or do you see it as Ashley is an outlier in some of the horrific cruelties and abuses that have been brought to the fore? Or do you see much the same in the testimonies that have come to yourself, and you can only speak with only so much permissibility at this stage, from what's come before you? Do you see a sameness of the 17 juvenile detention centres across Australia, is what I'm trying to get to, but is the deficit across the country? But is Ashley, what's your views on Ashley?
I think it's a variation on a theme. I think that what we're seeing across Australia is juvenile facilities that undermine juveniles' fundamental human rights, and again have no upside, and again amount to cruel, unusual punishment and or torture, right? So it's not surprising to me that there's another place in which this is happening. What I will say about Royal Commissions is that I appreciate that they have a place, but they cost a lot of money, they take a lot of time, and they don't actually impose change on the legislature. They suggest it. And we can see what suggestions have done for Western Australia. I mean, they've had decades of OIKS, that's the Office of the Inspector of Custodial Services, giving damning reports into everything that is wrong in Banksia Hill. And it's resulted in no real change. So I hope that this Royal Commission is different. I hope the findings actually result in some real change. But again, it remains to be seen.
And the last question from a regular listener to the station is, what do you think, what was your impression or your response to Justice Hilton Quayle, to remind listeners that he's the president of the Children's Court, about his exceptional and rarer than once in a generation type stance from a head of an instrument of state to come out and make the comments that I'll let you describe, that he made about Banksia Hill not fit for purpose, and this is how you create a monster. and that he wouldn't sentence a child to Banksia because Banksia wasn't fit for purpose. What did you think of that stance?
I thought, great. I thought it was a wonderful speech, but I was sorry to see that it didn't really make much of a difference because that kid did end up in Banksia Hill, and even worse, was then transferred to Unit 18. I know that because I happen to know the child in question. So,
just for listeners, it's important to understand that the justice didn't send him to Banksia Hill. He put him on a community order, but so it was an arrest and release effort. But he breached his order, and he finished up in Banksia Hill again, and then in Casuarina. So it also goes to the heart of the issues of the through care, the safety plans, the care plans aren't being put in support, and the services to turn to aren't funded to do so.
Yep, that's all very true. And I mean, judicial criticism is all well and good, but until such time as children are not being subjected to the conditions that they are at Banksia Hill and Unit 18, it's kind of hollow and meaningless, because I know that the child in question has been tortured for the last couple of months. So, I mean, what? It's hard not to throw your hands up in the air at this point.
Yeah. Donna, just wanting to ask your thoughts on the Disability Royal Commission that's coming to Perth. We have a public hearing 27, and that specifically is about conditions in detention in the criminal justice system.
In reference to psychosocial disabilities of people presenting before the criminal justice system.
So that's going to happen between the 19th to the 23rd of this month, and there's quite a few witnesses that will be giving evidence throughout the course of the week, some with lived experience, some experts, some from community. So we're expecting some really strong recommendations to come from it. But I just wanted to know what your thoughts were in relation to the Disabilities Royal Commission.
I think that the extent of disability amongst juveniles in Banksia Hill is underappreciated by people. So when you consider that these children are children, and children are inherently, you know, naughty sometimes and, you know, lack control over their impulses, etc., and then you add a level of disability on top of that, and then you put someone in a very punitive, authoritarian environment and expect them to be able to behave in a very ordered and obedient manner, right? Now, that's totally unreasonable. If these children were not in detention, if they were white kids from an affluent suburb in Perth, they would have a tutor, they'd have all sorts of psychological and learning supports given to them, and they'd probably go on to be quite successful people. Now, the kids that are put in Banksia Hill are not only denied any sort of real education, but they're also put in a place where there's very little access to psychological and psychosocial support. So the opportunity to diagnose them and to treat them and to manage their condition passes them by, and then they act out in jail, in detention. Then they get charged with a detention offence, then they have to serve more time, then they act out again, and the cycle continues. So you end up with a situation where there's no real end in sight for a kid who's disabled and unsupported in detention. It just is an endless cycle of trauma, offending, and detention.
Can you let listeners understand the context of how long they're actually locked down? At the best of times, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's a 6 or 7 hours that they get outside their cell, 6 or 7 hours, if I'm right. When we talk about rolling lockdowns, they're usually inside for 23 out of the 24 hours or 23 and a half hours out of the 24 hours. But even at the best of times, they're 6 or 7 hours that they get out. So they're locked down all the time, even at the best of times, for 16, 17 hours.
I mean, I just think that people who you need to lock yourself in a toilet cubicle with nothing and stare at a wall for 23 hours to understand what these children experience day in, day out, for months on end. Now, I would panic if I was locked in a bathroom for an hour. I can't imagine what it's like to have no one to speak to, nothing to do. I mean, that if you try and take books or magazines in to Banksia Hill to give to a detainee, they're confiscated for you, from you, right? So these kids have got no school, no social interaction. All they've got to do is stare at a wall. And then people wonder why, you know, they might smash up their TV or do something in desperation, which then results in them getting into more trouble and being detained for longer. And it all begins all over again.
People are barracking for you. Families are barracking for you. Thousands of people across the country, more and more people across the country are learning. You've opened up a narrative. But I think of Ashley. Ashley's only 11 or 12 kids at any one time. In the whole of Tasmania, juvenile detention at any one time, forgetting how many prison entrants over the year, at any one time is 11 or 12 kids. And we can't get it right. We can't even get one-on-one support for 11 or 12 kids, for a dozen children at any one time. If we can't get it right for Ashley, is there any propensity for hope that we can get it right for all the other juvenile detention centres across the country? Reminding listeners that there's about 900 children in Australia at any one time in the 17 children's jails, because that's what they are. But if we can't get it right for 12 kids, how are we going to get it right for everybody else? Give us some hope. Shine the light.
I think we're getting to a point where our position, well, when I say ours, it's certainly not mine or any, but anyone that I'm speaking to right now, the turning a blind eye to this kind of mistreatment on such a grand scale of children doesn't have a place in the 21st century, and it certainly doesn't have a place in the court of international law, right? We are parties to a number of international conventions that that should be holding our governments to a standard that doesn't result in the kind of harm we're seeing in Western Australia, South Australia and the Northern Territory. So really, I think, you know, it's time for the public to care about the waste of money that this all is. I mean, it costs so much more to do what we're doing with no upside than it would to give people a real life and some hope. So I think we just need to sit down and look at this unemotionally in a cost-benefit analysis. And anyone with any kind of intelligence will see that what's going on right now is all cost, no benefit, and it's time there's a real change.
See, one of the things that I get sick of hearing and seeing over in Western Australia is the whole thing where our children are being demonised. So we know that the media sometimes reports that the children are in the wrong, the family's in the wrong. But the reality is that there's not enough support, there's not enough housing, there's not enough, you know, love and care in that respect. So that's one of the frustrating things for me when our children continue to be demonised.
I think that in the case of the children that have been transferred to Unit 18 and the way that the media portrayed those children as like the most willfully destructive, violent kids was tantamount to racial vilification in my mind, because those kids weren't willfully destructive out of the blue, right? They acted out because they had been subject to months of solitary confinement, which was recently of a kind that was much more severe than that which was recently deemed unlawful in the Supreme Court a couple of weeks ago. So these kids have been subjected to the worst kind of solitary confinement. That's why they destroyed their cells, and that's how they landed up in Unit 18. Now, whose fault is that? Is it the kids' fault, or is it the department's fault? Because you have to look at what causes people to behave in a certain way, right? And the buck stops the department, in my mind. There's no question about that.
You nailed it there for us all. On that note, we've run out of time, but we'll have you back when you launch the class action in the federal court and take it from there once again. But it's been great having you on. obviously you and I get to talk regularly, and you and Megan talk for hours on end day after day.
Yeah.
But it's just been, well, inspirational listening to Dana Levitt and what Dana Levitt and her father, Stuart Levitt, two champion lawyers, are doing on behalf of our most marginalised kids. And as I've said before, and as you said, as Megan has said, there are no more vulnerable kids than the children of juvenile detention, of children's prisons. So all honour to you.
Yep.
And our prayers are bent towards the hope that you compel social reforms and the courts rule favourably. Thank you, Dana.
Thanks, Dana. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks.